You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Since 2003, at least 9 Americans have come forward to allege that the United States government orchestrated their detention in other countries and that the FBI pressured them to become informants. One of those cases is that of Naji Mansour, who secretly recorded conversations with FBI agents. Journalist Nick Bauman tells Naji Mansour's story in an article in the May-June issue of Mother Jones magazine called "There's No Law for Me Here, What Happens When You Refuse to Become an Informant for the FBI." I'm pleased it brings Nick Bauman to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Naji Mansour's story is complicated. Can you summarize for us what you think is most important about him in this case?
Sure. I think the most important thing to understand here is this is an American citizen who's living abroad, and he gets into some trouble while he's abroad, and he reports that to the embassy voluntarily. He goes into the U.S. embassy and reports it, and at that point he's asked to become an informant, and he says, well, you know, I'll tell you whatever you need to know, but I'm not interested in becoming an informant for hire for the U.S. government. And he believes that, and I think I lay out a great deal of evidence in this article, he believes that because he refused to cooperate in that manner, he and his family were mistreated and that the U.S. government was behind that.
Why did the government think that he would make a good informant?
Well, I think the thing to understand about there are a couple things. One is that he's a conservative Muslim. He's living abroad. He travels a lot. He traveled doing refugee flights for the UN Migration Agency. He's soft-spoken. He's very convincing. You know, he speaks both English and Arabic, so he could sort of move fluidly between different worlds. But I think more importantly is that, you know, when he came in and told them his story, they probably had some suspicions that he was tied to terrorist groups. He had the story that he tells is that during his travels, he often would go and he'd meet new people and he'd say, well, my mom has this house in Nairobi in Kenya. And if you're ever traveling through the area, look me up, you know, just as you or I would tell new acquaintances or people we meet when we're traveling, you know, look me up whenever you're in my case, D.C. And so in 2009, in February, he got a call from someone he remembered vaguely from the mosque in Dubai where he had been working. And that person said, Naji, I know you're in Nairobi right now, and I have two of my friends are coming through town. Could they stay with you? And he wanted to ask for some more details, but the line cut out. But he did agree to let them stay, and he just figured no harm. You know, they have a lot of room in their house. They were used to having house guests.
And the two proved to be wannabe terrorists.
Yeah. Those two men were deported at the time. They weren't charged with anything. The Kenyan anti-terror police raided the house and deported these guys. And the Kenyans actually arrested Naji Mansour and his wife, and they interrogated them quite a bit, but they didn't charge them with anything either. And so he sort of thought his problems were over and he should tell the U.S. government what had happened. And actually, his problems were just getting started at that point.
He was born in the United States?
His mother's American. He was actually born outside the United States. Some of his siblings were born in the States, and he's always had a U.S. passport. His late father was Sudanese.
Why was it that the FBI was trying to recruit Mansour or others and not the CIA or the NSA?
The FBI sort of has exclusive jurisdiction with regards to Americans abroad. And so I think because of his American citizenship, that's part of the reason he was dealing with the FBI. But also, he did interact with some people from the State Department, State Diplomatic Security. So it wasn't exclusively that he was dealing with the FBI. And I do, you know, of course, there's a chance that anyone who you talk to in the U.S. government may not be working for who they say they're working for.
How did you find out about Naji Mansour?
So I've been reporting for several years about this phenomenon of Americans abroad who are suspected of terrorism, who are arrested by foreign countries and then interrogated in foreign custody by American authorities. And so I'd been the first to report the story of a man named Yonis Fikri, who was living in Sudan, was asked to become an informant, declined, and claims that later when he was traveling through the United Arab Emirates, that he was basically arrested and thrown into secret detention and tortured, he believes, at the behest of the United States. And actually, he, after he was released, he moved to Sweden, where he's seeking political asylum in Sweden because he fears returning to the United States.
Were all of these nine people tortured? In the case of Naji, the pressure sounds rather extreme, more like strong arm and blackmail.
Yeah, so not everyone alleges that they were tortured. Naji specifically told me he was not. But he did compare his case to Fikri. The way I first heard about his story was that he emailed me, having seen the Fikri story, and said, "My case seems very familiar to the, you know, very similar to this." So he sort of saw the parallels himself early on. But he says he was never tortured. He heard other people being beaten.
My guest is Nick Bauman, whose article "There Is No Law for Me Here: What Happens When You Refuse to Become an Informant for the FBI, You Don't Want to Find Out," is in the current issue of Mother Jones. We have a clip from a call that Naji recorded with FBI agents. Let's listen.
"You will remember this day, and you're going to say, I should have talked to these guys. And I shouldn't have been doing little excuses. You know, if you did have any kind of business going on today or any kind of things like that, you're going to find how minuscule and worthless it was compared to this fork in the road that you're about to..."
What are you talking about? No, why don't you come out and say it? Why don't you come out and say, what fork in the road are you talking about?
Dude, honestly, I don't care. I'm getting out of here. I don't care. Okay? And it's, you know, when I tell somebody, hey, you know what? If you cross the street without looking, you're going to get run over. That's not a threat. You know, that's advice. Okay?
Do you know what?
And you're about to cross the street without looking both ways.
No.
And I'm telling you, you know what? You might get hit by a car. That is not a threat. That is a solid piece of advice. But you don't want to take it.
Do we know the names, the identities of these agents? They were bleeped out along with a swear word in the clip that we heard.
Yeah, I know the names of the agents, and Naji knows the names, but when I went to the FBI for comment on this, they requested that for the safety of these individuals that we withhold the names from publication, and given the arguments that they made, we decided to comply with that. We don't have to do it, and they never demanded that we do it, but in this particular case, it was a judgment call, and we decided not to name them.
Well, it gets kind of scary when the FBI agent tells him about, says things like, "You're about to cross the street without looking both ways," and then says, "This is..." What does he say? It's not a threat, but he makes it sound like it is a threat. Is he speaking metaphorically, or is Naji reasonable in thinking of it as a threat?
I think any time you have to tell someone that you're not threatening them, it probably means you're threatening them. If you have to say, "Oh, well, I'm not threatening you, but blah, blah, blah," that sounds like a threat to me. And I think in the full context of everything that was said in this conversation, which you can listen to on our website, actually, I think it's pretty clear that this FBI agent is telling Naji, "Look, we have stuff that we want you to do, and if you don't do it, it's going to be very bad for you."
And also, they said, and kind of suggested, it would be bad for members of his family as well.
Yeah, so there's another clip in which the agent says that there's scrutiny on Najee's mother, Sandra Mansour. And she, at the time, she was working for a U.S. government contractor in Juba in South Sudan. So basically, she was working for a contractor with the U.S. Agency for International Development. And actually, a few days, several days after this conversation, she was fired from her job, despite having renewed her contract the day before, several days before she was fired. And so she believes, and Najee believes, and the rest of their family believes, that that was retaliation for his refusal to cooperate.
Why did Najee decide to record his conversation with the FBI agents?
So at this point in his ordeal, he had been imprisoned in Juba in South Sudan for 37 days earlier that year, and these FBI agents had come and visited him at the prison and questioned him in the prison. And he came to believe, both because of that experience and because of people that he and his family had talked to in Sudan and South Sudan and in Kenya, that his imprisonment had been orchestrated by the United States. And so he wanted to confront these agents with his belief that they were behind his detention, and he wanted to sort of record that for posterity, I guess. He did confront them, and they did deny that they had any involvement in his detention. But I think if you read the story and you look at all the circumstances, there's a lot of coincidences you have to believe are coincidences in order to believe that the United States had absolutely no role in any of this.
And the FBI just simply refuses to comment on these recordings other than to ask you to redact the names?
Yeah. So on the recording specifically, the FBI has not commented. On the general charge that Najee and his family are making, that they were that the FBI recommended he be detained in South Sudan, the FBI denies that. And they also they deny that they made any recommendations with regards to Sandra's employment status. However, when I talked to the U.S. Agency for International Development, they gave me what we in the journalism business sometimes call a non-denial denial. They said that ultimately the decision about whether to hire or fire anyone, I'm paraphrasing, at a USAID contractor is made by the contractor themselves. So they didn't explicitly deny that they had told this contractor to fire Sandra. And in fact, Sandra's former boss or one of her former bosses at this contractor told me that the U.S. government did indeed request that they get rid of her.
My guess is Nick Bauman, his article, "There's No Law for Me Here, What Happens When You Refuse to Become an Informant for the FBI, You Don't Want to Find Out," is in the May-June issue of Mother Jones magazine. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Nick Bauman, his article, "There's No Law for Me Here, What Happens When You Refuse to Become an Informant for the FBI, You Don't Want to Find Out," is in the May-June issue of Mother Jones. Nick, did the United States ever seriously suspect Najee Mansour of being tied to terrorists, or is there an attitude that as many sources of information should be lined up as humanly possible?
So I believe, and I think from listening to these recordings, you can sort of gather that the FBI's main interest in Najee Mansour was recruiting him as an informant, not figuring out what these two guys had been doing at his house.
Well, there was also a relative, wasn't there, who was tied to terrorists?
Yeah. So there's a relative whose name is, I believe, Omar Awad Omar, who's a distant cousin of Najee's, who was later charged in the World Cup bombings in Uganda, charged with sort of financing them. I should note that Omar denies this and said that basically he was tortured in Ugandan custody, and there's a Supreme Court case pending there. so that, you know, that person maintains his innocence. But I do think that there, it doesn't seem from my reporting that they were trying to build some sort of case against him. It seems to me that they were interested in someone who they thought might know some people and might have some connections that would make him useful as an informant.
Well, the other red flags go off when people travel a lot, especially to areas where terrorists may be. And this family traveled an awful lot.
Yeah, so they basically traveled their whole lives. They grew up traveling all around the world. Naji went to school in, you know, four or five different places, just from elementary school into primary school until high school. But once they saw Nairobi, they sort of fell in love with that, and they did somewhat settle there after that.
Well, part of this story involves the fact that Naji and others were picked up by the police in the various countries that they were living in, and then somehow the FBI or suggestions of U.S. involvement came into play. So is the assumption that U.S. citizens who are suspected of ties to terrorists are detained and questioned abroad by foreign security services at the behest of American authorities? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think that's basically the central issue here. That
this is different than rendition, isn't it?
Yes, very different. So in rendition, what's happening is that the U.S. is picking someone up and giving them to a third, another country. In these cases, the foreign country is picking up the people themselves, and the U.S. is never in custody of the actual person. But civil libertarians allege that it's sort of a rendition light, and that basically U.S. law enforcement and intelligence agencies are using these detentions of Americans and non-Americans to get around basically due process rights. So, for example, if you're being held in a prison in one of our allied countries in Africa or the Middle East, it's very unlikely that you actually have to be charged with anything or brought before a judge. It's extremely unlikely that you'll get access to a lawyer. Those are all things that will advantage your interrogators when they're questioning you. And although the FBI constitutionally and as a matter of policy has to abide by its own rules and by the Constitution when operating abroad, it does sort of when FBI agents interrogate Americans in foreign custody, oftentimes those Americans claim that they would ask for lawyers or that they would want to stop this interrogation, and the FBI wouldn't comply. The FBI denies this, of course.
And Naji suggests that a number of the people who had arrested him said that they had actually done it at the behest of the U.S. government.
Yeah, so Naji's father was very well-connected in North and South Sudan. He was an economist. He consulted with various governments and corporations. And so that their family talked to a number of people, and I talked to a number of people anonymously who either hinted or said outright that the U.S. was behind these sorts of operations. And to be clear, when I first started reporting on this a couple of years ago, the FBI did admit to me that sometimes the information it shares, it gave me a formal on-the-record statement, that sometimes the information it shares with foreign countries does result in the arrest of American citizens. And it acknowledged that sometimes FBI agents are given the opportunity to interview American citizens and other prisoners held in foreign custody. So this is a real thing that happens.
Has the Obama administration or the FBI issued any kind of statement in response to your report?
They haven't, beyond the statements that they gave me as I was preparing the report. They haven't issued any comments since publication. So no. And oftentimes you find with these government agencies that they're very reluctant to comment on anything that could conceivably be connected to national security matters. So you do very much have to rely on documents and interviews with people outside the agency.
The title of your piece, "There's No Law for Me Here," is something Naji said to American agents. What did he mean by that?
So Naji was saying that he didn't want to work for the government, for the U.S. government, while he was living in Africa, because he was afraid that, you know, as a foreigner abroad, that he would not be protected. And I talked to some experts on informants for this story, and usually people who agree to become an informant, oftentimes they are under threat of indictment or have actually been indicted for a crime, charged with a crime, and they're sort of helping to wipe the slate clean by doing that, by agreeing to become informants. But Naji was never charged with anything. And so he really didn't feel like he had the need. He needed to risk his life, which is what he'd be doing if he's going to go spy on people who are allegedly terrorists. He didn't want to.
Nick Bauman's article, "There's No Law for Me Here: What Happens When You Refuse to Become an Informant for the FBI You Don't Want to Find Out," is in the May-June issue of Mother Jones. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In the U.S., there have been calls for lower standards of justice in investigating suspected terrorists. Other countries have been used to do end runs around American law. Is there law for Naji or the other eight people who have had similar experiences anywhere, given how the United States justice system has proceeded in the post 9/11 climate?
That's a really great question, and I think sort of one of the great examples of this is one of the first allegations of this was a gentleman named Abu Ali, that's his last name, who was arrested in Saudi Arabia while he was taking exams during the Bush administration, and he was actually held there for 18 months, something around 18 months, and his family back in the United States sued the government saying, well, he's being held at the behest of the United States by the Saudis, and when the judge was about to rule in their favor or looked like he was going to allow some discovery in the case, Abu Ali was miraculously released and deported to the United States, where he was charged, and he was convicted based on a statement, a confession that he gave in Saudi custody that he said he had given because he was being brutally tortured. And so it's very, very hard for people. It's very, very rare for people who are accused of terrorism in court to be able to prove their innocence. And when people say that they've been victimized by the government, oftentimes the government uses this sort of get-out-of-jail-free card or get-out-of-court-free card that it has called the state secrets doctrine, where it basically says, well, even considering this case would damage national security, and so we can't continue with this case. And you see that in wiretapping cases and detention cases, national security cases. And so it's very, very hard for people like Naji Mansour and these other men who've been detained abroad to find real justice, especially if they want to gain some sort of compensation for their suffering. It's very, very hard.
Do you have anything beyond the statements of Naji Mansour and his family to confirm his account?
Well, the great thing about this story and what made me want to write it is that in a lot of these cases, all you have is the word of the accused and the word of the people who say that they were in prison. Maybe you have some circumstantial evidence. The great thing about this case is it's really well documented. You have this, hour plus recording with between the FBI and Naji Mansour, in which a lot of his story is sort of backed up. You know, the fact that he was detained. The State Department actually confirmed to me that he was detained in Juba, and they confirmed that State Department officials had visited him there. And I also obtained from an anonymous source, I obtained a South Sudanese document describing Naji Mansour's detention. That was actually later forwarded to the U.S. Embassy. So it's very clear that a lot of these events happened, and there's a lot of backup and supporting information. So that was what was so appealing about the story to me, that it was so well documented.
After the recorded conversation, Naji and his family tried to travel. They had American passports, didn't they?
Yeah.
So what happened?
They're all Americans. So interestingly, basically everyone in Naji's family has had trouble since he refused to cooperate or refused to become an informant, has had trouble crossing international borders and sometimes other trouble. He has a brother who's a U.S. Marine who served 2 tours in Afghanistan. His brother was questioned by the Navy Criminal Investigative Service. He has another brother who has trouble anytime he tries to travel across international borders. His sister had trouble getting into Kenya, where she has lived. His mother was basically told she could not reenter Kenya and where her home is, and was not able to get back there until very recently, when she was evacuated from Juba on an evacuation flight, and that's when she was finally able to get back in.
And then FBI agents popped up again.
Yeah. So basically, throughout their travels of not just Naji but the rest of his family, FBI agents have come and contacted them and asked them questions about him and about the family, and they very much, you know, this has been going on for 5 years now, and the two men who stayed at Naji's mother's house at the family home in Nairobi, those two men are dead now. They've been dead for 2 years, and so the family just really wants this to be over. They want to be able to get back to their lives, and they feel that they can't do that. Naji feels he can't even travel safely. He's afraid that, like Yunus Fikre or some of these other men, that if he travels to a U.S. allied country, he risks arrest and torture.
So he feels that even though right now there seems to be a bit of a hiatus, this could pop up at any time?
Yeah, I think that he does. He's still worried, and I know for a fact, I personally witnessed that the government is still interested in him, because when I went to go visit him in Khartoum, we went to the U.S. Embassy so that he could renew his passport, which of course he hasn't used because he's been afraid to travel, We sat there, and he went up to the window. Everything seemed normal, but we kept sitting there. And other people who had arrived after us had their passports processed and returned to them. And finally, a voice came over the loudspeaker and said, "Naji Mansour, can you go to window number 6?" But there was no window number 6. It was actually a soundproofed room marked interview room. He was asked to go in there for an interview, asked about his, he says he was asked about his travels in there, and he was asked whether he was still willing to, they didn't ask him to become an informant, but one of the people he spoke to asked if he would be willing to meet with them again in the future. So he continues to be treated differently than other Americans abroad.
What's happened to the other 8 men that the FBI tried to recruit? Are they going through similar experiences?
It's really varied. So Abu Ali, who I mentioned earlier, is serving, I believe, life in prison, in federal prison. His brother actually wrote a great piece about him recently, I think in Salon, talking about his brother being in prison. There's another, but some people are free and not sort of laying low. Some people are free and have sued the government. Amir Mishaal, who was arrested crossing the Kenyan border from Somalia in 2007, I believe. And then he says he was rendered, he was sort of arrested and rendered to Ethiopia and Somalia and to secret prisons there and interrogated by the FBI and other U.S. Officials in foreign custody. He's sued the U.S. government, and his case is pending. Another young man from Virginia named Gulat Mohammed, who I've written a lot about, who was detained in Kuwait in 2011, I believe. He has sued the U.S. government. His case is ongoing. But a lot of them are running into these problems that I mentioned earlier, where the government really has a leg up in a lot of these court cases. It's very, very hard to move forward.
Just one more thing, Nick. Did the government offer to pay Naji to be an informant?
Oh yeah, so that's part of the deal. Usually, when you agree to become an informant for the FBI or another government agency, he was offered. They said, we could pay you for information, or we could pay you basically a salary. That would require continued information. But the FBI is a network. We've reported of somewhere in the neighborhood of 15,000 informants, basically an informant everywhere in every mosque in America. The vast majority of those people are paid, and they're always looking for more informants. So, that's sort of part of the deal. And
how much are they paying? I'm looking for another job.
I don't actually know. It can it really varies. I think based on the informant themselves, the value of the information, what the informant would be doing otherwise. But certainly there are informants who have made tens of thousands and sometimes hundreds, in the six figures.
My guest is Nick Bauman. His article, "There Is No Law for Me, What happens when you refuse to become an informant for the FBI? You don't want to find out." It's in the May-June issue of Mother Jones. And, Nick, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.